Carson Gully was a master of the culinary arts and one of Wisconsin's most famous chefs. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. And if you visit the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus today, you most likely come across Carson Gully Commons. From 1927 to 1954, Gully served as the university head chef and was one of the first African-Americans to work there. So today we're remembering Gully's legacy as a chef and as a media pioneer with our guest today, Scott Seaforth. Scott is an assistant director of residence life at Academic Initiatives at UW-Madison. And back in 2016, he wrote an article for the Wisconsin Magazine of History, and it was titled The Life and Times of Carson Gully. And so we thought it'd be great to have him come by and talk with us. Do you remember watching Carson Gully on TV or maybe listening to him on the radio? What questions do you have about this iconic figure? You can call in. It's easy to do. Just call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Give a call or shoot us an email. Scott Seaforth, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be with you.
Well, let's tell us about Carson's family and his life as a child. Let's go back.
Right. Gully is born in 1897 in Arkansas. He's the third of 10 children. And his parents grew cotton. You know, he started picking cotton in the fields at age of six. His father really believed in education. And his father apprenticed him to a teacher in a nearby community when Gully was in his teens to help in exchange for tutoring, because there was not good teaching available in their separate and unequal educational system. And so Gully took high school in that manner and passed, and then went and got a 2-year teaching degree and came back and taught in his local, the local school there. He had the one-room schoolhouse for 3 years and really learned the teacherly skills that he would use for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And when did he just develop this interest in cooking?
Yeah, it wasn't what he thought he would do. He was, which is how it is for many of us, right?
Yeah. Oh boy.
While he was teaching in Arkansas, he was also a sharecropper. And of course, a sharecropper was no way to get ahead. It was no way to make money. And he realized this wasn't going to work. And so he was part of the 1.6 million African Americans in the early, late teens, early 20s, who left the South and moved north looking for better economic opportunities and trying to leave the really blatant violence of Jim Crow South. And he tried different things. He tried construction, but the place he got hired went out of business. And then he took a job as an apprentice short order cook, and the head cook left, and he ended up staying there. And he realized that he liked cooking, and went about trying to learn to be a better chef. And so in the early 20s, he did everything. He cooked on the trains. He cooked in, in hotels. He moved around trying to advance his skills.
It's really cool. And it pretty much, I suppose, he learned from other chefs or other people who were cooking and then just the whole bit about doing it.
Right. African-Americans. Okay. There were chef training schools, and they largely were not open to African Americans at this time. And so, like you say, Gully had to learn on the job. And he got, yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he eventually ended up at a hotel in St. Louis after he had advanced his skills after about 4 years, and was at a hotel in St. Louis, and the head of Principia Academy, which was a very large prep school, like 1,500 students or more, tasted his food and hired him away to run this prep school dining cafeteria, and which he did for 4 years before he came to Madison, before he got recruited from Madison. And so he had learned how to run a really big operation by being at this boarding school.
And then I was wondering how he wound up in Wisconsin, and so he was kind of recruited, do you think? Or?
Well, it's interesting story. I mean, Gully was, the boarding school was just a September to May school, and it closed down over the summer. So there was no summer work for him. And so every summer he had to go find a different place to work. And he worked the summer resorts because it was just limited term. So he worked a summer resort in Kansas 1 year, and he was there, and then in Florida 1 year, and then he was up at Lake Chautauqua in New York for 1 year. And then in the summer of 1926, he was at Essex Lodge in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. And the head of the university dorms, Don Halverson, was driving up to a cabin that he had far north of Tomahawk, but it was bad weather and raining like crazy, and he needed a place to stay, and he pulled into this lodge and late at night, and Gully made him dinner, and it was amazing. And even at 11 o'clock at night, when he didn't need to, and the man, Halverson, decided to stay an extra day and a half. And he got to know Gully and learn what he could do as a chef. They went fishing. You know, they hung out at night. And by the time that Halverson left, a day and a half later, he asked Gully, if there were to be an opening, would he come to Madison? And Gully said yes. And shortly thereafter, that's how Gully arrived.
Isn't it amazing how these chance things sometimes work out? Bad storm. Yeah. If not for that, if he'd kept going, Don Halverson, Carson Gully probably would never have wound up at the UW.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Scott Seaforth, our guest today. We're taking a little historical look today at the life and times of Carson Gully. And you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So when when you're talking about the head chef, did he start as the head chef, or what was his first sort of role at UW Madison?
Right. I mean, Gully, head chef.
Or was he ever considered to be the head chef?
This was the problem. In this era, an African-American man could never get advanced into a position where they would supervise white people. Even in 1950, when the university did an examination of all the African-Americans, there were like 300 or something African-Americans that worked at the university, only one of them was supervising people, and they had their staff was all people of color. And that was the only reason they were allowed to be a supervisor. So it didn't matter how good Gully was. He could never get the advancement that he deserved. But what he did do is he essentially ran the dining operation in what is now the building named after him, which was one of the main dining operations on the lakeshore.
So what type of dishes did he enjoy making on campus?
Well, he liked doing things that pleased the students, to be honest. And he, it's really interesting. Like, today, like, university communications likes to like talk up his fudge bottom pie all the time. and it's one of the only things people know him for, because it's like for 40 years, it's the only way almost that university communications has presented him to the public is as in relationship to fudge, bun, and pie. And I've read over 100 interviews that he gave during his lifetime, and he never once mentions fudge, bun, and pie as anything that he's proud of. Not that he wasn't proud of it, but when you ask him the recipes that he was proudest of, that does not come up. That is a, something that is a was a creation of university communications after his death. Not that it wasn't there, not that people didn't love it. Okay, I'm not. Don't get me wrong. But when he's when during his lifetime, oftentimes when in interviews, when you ask what he's most proud of, he was most proud of his baked bean recipe. And I have to tell you, I always wondered about that until I tried this recipe. Somebody made it for me once at a talk I gave about Gully, and they brought this recipe, and it is fantastic. And now I.
All right, somebody's. I mean, is it the traditional? Let's just go all that. Let's go down that rabbit hole for a minute. Does it involve brown sugar and bacon, or can you remember just off the top of your head?
Right. What makes it unusual is not the ingredients, but the way it's cooked. It is slow cooked for 24 hours.
Oh,
yeah.
24 hours. So he must have started with fresh beans, beans that weren't already cooked.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Right. and he soaked the beans and the whole thing. Yeah.
And he'd soak the beans and then do them for 24 hours. So that's something I haven't done yet. I do like my mother-in-law makes these great. This great baked bean recipe that I always get for my birthday. And so I'll have to look up the recipe that he had for his baked beans. Well, Scott C. Forth, our guest today, Assistant Director of Residence Life at Academic Initiatives at UW-Madison. And he wrote an article on the history of the life and times of Carson Gully. And I hope he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today, and we'll have a lot more to talk with him about it. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Scott Seaforth. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look today at an honorable and notable person, Carson Gully. I'm Larry Mueller. Welcome to the show. We're talking about Gully's legacy as a celebrity chef and TV radio host during the 50s and early 60s and his efforts to break down racial barriers. Scott Seaforth, our guest, Assistant Director of Residence Life at Academic Initiatives at UW-Madison. And he wrote an article for the Wisconsin Magazine of History called The Life and Times of Carson Gully. So did you watch Carson Gully on TV or listen on the radio way back when? What do you remember about him? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And callers online, let's go to Rick in Madison. Rick, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I grew up in Madison in the 60s. I'm 65. And my middle name is Carson. And my uncles used to teasingly call me Richard Carson Gully Gut Gunderman. And I wonder, is a Carson Gully Gut, was that a term instead of the freshman 15 at the UW?
Carson Gully Gut instead of the freshman 15.
I never heard anything like that.
I don't think so. I don't remember it either, and I was around back in those days as well. But there you go, Rick. John in Rhinelander, let's go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to call in. My mother actually worked under Carson Gully's supervision during World War II. She was a cook when they were feeding a couple thousand military people that were being trained on campus.
Oh.
And she worked as a cook much of her life in schools and later for caterer doing weddings and so forth. But Carson Gully trained her how to feed large numbers of people. And with all the supervisors she had, she said he was head and shoulders above anyone when it came to feeding large groups of people with good food that they liked.
Oh, man. John, thanks for calling. Scott, are you familiar with that part of Carson's life?
Yeah, what a lovely tribute that John offered from his mother. And I hear that all the time. We interviewed like over 40 people that knew Gully for this article. And that was what John just said is a common thing you would hear in that working with him was one of the best experiences that he had as for working with somebody, for his collegiality and how he treated people, and that his ability to do high quality food for large numbers was really extraordinary. And while he had high expectations, you know, he also, what the output was kind of was extraordinary. And wow, it's really lovely. You know, and it is true that Gully, you know, in the 30s, Tuskegee University hired Gully to create a chef's training course for them at Tuskegee, which became a two-year program. And Gully got a leave of absence from the university to create that course for Tuskegee University in Alabama. Then during World War II, the U.S. Navy asked Gully if he could do a shortened version of that course for every cook that they needed to train in the Navy. So every naval cook from the United States Navy that was before they got sent out, they came and they lived in Tribune Adams Hall and down here on Lakeshore, and they were trained by Gully in this class that he developed at the building that's now named after him. Yeah. And then they were shipped off around the world.
Man, that's great. John, thanks so much for calling. What a great tribute to your mother as well. And I appreciate that call. Stella has something. Stella from Sturgeon Bay has something I was going to ask you about anyway, but she's got some real life experience to share as well. Stella, thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having this program. It's a joy. I was born and raised in Madison, and grew up in Crestwood, the Wisconsin Cooperative Housing Association, better known as Crestwood. And I would guess it would be in the mid-50s. It was when I was in elementary school that Mr. and Mrs. Gully bought a house in Crestwood and moved into the neighborhood. And by and large, I think most people in the community very much supported them moving in. Unfortunately, there were a few people who, because of racial prejudice, were opposed. But they bought a house and moved in. And my kid's eye perspective is that Mr. and Mrs. Gully's house was the absolutely favorite spot for trick-or-treating because they baked cookies that were absolutely delicious, and you had to get there early because they always ran out.
Stella, what a wonderful story. Thank you so much for calling. And I was going to ask you, what they did for housing, because back in those times, they were different. And here's a great call to describe some of that. Scott.
Wow. Stella, thank you so much. Gully, when he moved here in 26, he just had a terrible time finding housing. There were restrictive covenants on deeds. You couldn't buy housing. African Americans could not buy housing except in several very small prescribed areas in Madison, none of which were by the university. So if you worked at the university, you wouldn't want to live, where the city told African Americans to live. He would get rooms in apartment buildings, and then the white neighbors would circulate petitions, and he would be asked to leave. And that happened routinely for a series of years until finally he got an offer to go work elsewhere because he was tired of dealing with the housing problem. And this is 1936. And Don Halverson, the director of university housing, said that he'd fix this in the only way that he could, which is he built an apartment for Gully in a building next door to the building that Gully worked in the basement in Tripp Hall. And Gully moved into this apartment in this basement of Tripp Hall, and he lived there for the next 20 years.
Man.
Yeah, he continued to fight. This is the part of Gully's life that we tend to not tell in Madison is the way that he used his professional and his public stature to challenge, you know, the persistent practices of racial segregation and exclusion in that time. You know, Gully, starting in the 1940s, Gully was trying to purchase property in town. He had realtors and white folk who would work with him. And the white folk would go in, and this realtor who was in on this would work with a couple, and the white couple would show up and say, "Hey, well, we're buying this home for a friend who can't be here right now," and they would agree to the purchase of the home. And then at the signing, the Gullies would show up, and then oftentimes they would scuttle it because of the racial laws at that moment. Or sometimes they allowed the Gullies to sign and then legally scuttle it afterwards because of the segregation laws in Madison. They would use the law against them. And so it wasn't until, and there's articles about in the paper for Gully doing this for 10 years. Gully was a really important member of the local chapter of the NAACP, which is very active in Madison in the 1940s and 50s. And finally, in this Crestwood, which is what Stella was talking about, finally in 1954, this development opened a little bit outside of the boundaries of the Madison, and it was a cooperative where the people that lived there created the rules. So Gully bought a piece of undeveloped property, and Marshall Urban was the developer that owned this, and mm-hmm. built a house. And before he could build it, the people, once again, the white folk that lived there passed around a petition and said, "We don't want them here." And they called for a vote of all the 120 members of this cooperative. And so they went to the local public, there was like a 6-week lead up to this where people had huge signs in their yards, 6-foot-high signs, "If they come, we go." And they had a public hearing, and one of the people at the hearing said that they demanded that everybody had to stand and announce their vote one by one in public, say their name and how they were voting about the Gullies moving in. And people have told me that about half of the people there really didn't want the Gullies to live there, and another half did, and they really didn't know how this vote would turn out. But that when it was public and when every newspaper in town was there and they had to stand up and put their name to it, they ended up voting 60-some% in favor of the Gullies moving in, and the Gullies moved in. Which isn't to say that that was wonderful. They had a cross burned in their yard. They had constant hate mail, phone calls. And it, even though, you know, they persisted, and it didn't mean that any other people of color moved in, and it did not change the laws in Madison at that time. In fact, Gully wouldn't live to see the change of the racial segregation laws in Madison.
Yeah, which is way too bad. Well, my mother and my grandmother watched his show. We haven't talked about his radio and TV work yet. I can remember them watching the show on TV. He hosted a weekly What's Cookin' show in the 50s and early 60s on WMTV Madison. And what was the show like? I mean, I just don't remember it, but I remember seeing it, you know, just briefly looking at it. I wasn't interested in cooking at the time. I didn't think much about it, but what was it like?
Well, it was a typical cooking show, you know, and, you know, cooking shows, of course, were ubiquitous at that time across America, as they are now. But it was very unusual to have an African-American leading a cooking show. In fact, there's articles in Ebony magazine from the 1950s where some of these articles count only 12 television programs at any one time during the 1950s in the United States of America featuring an African-American host. So, you know, it was unusual, and more unusual still that, you know, Gully hosted the show with his wife, Beatrice.
Yes.
So they were an African-American couple. It was the longest running television program starring an African American in the decade of the 50s in the United States of America. It ran for 10 years and only ceased because Gully died.
Yeah.
So it's remarkable on a number of levels, and they were fun, apparently.
A very high energy sort of couple there for sure. And he hosted a twice weekly local radio cooking program, and you could tell us more about that too.
Yeah, well, he's right. He starts on radio in the 40s, and in fact, he started on WHA, which is the forerunner of where we are now. We're broadcasting from currently, if I'm correct, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So, I mean, Gully really gets his start because of this station on the radio. It builds, and he becomes very popular as a radio show. So then it becomes natural. And so when TV came along, it was natural that he would transition. But the radio program made him a personality in a way that I think the fame that he had achieved is something that we forget. I mean, he became very well known, and he got asked to travel the state during the 40s and 50s, giving lectures on cooking. And he would give 1 to 3 talks a week in communities around the state. And he was everywhere. I mean, he was in Beloit, and he was up in Green Bay, and he was in Sheboygan, and he was in Cuba City, and he was over in Ellsworth. You know, he was talking to 400 people in Chicago and 700 people up in St. Paul at conventions. I mean, he was traveling the Midwest. And he was traveling the Midwest in the 1950s and 40s when, you know, there were just many of these towns that he was visiting. He was the only African American in that town. He was likely one of the few African Americans that had certainly ever been asked to come and speak in that town.
Or even than some people had ever seen in person.
Quite likely.
Yeah.
And many of these towns were sundown towns. You know, they had laws that said that African Americans could not live there. Yeah. You know, Manitowoc used to have a sign out front of it that said, N-words, don't let the sun go down on you in Manitowoc.
Yeah.
And that was up until the civil, you know, until 1964, until we passed a national law that said you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So, he was invited into these towns. I mean, picture what this must have been like for him. He would go, give his presentation, and then because there were no hotels that would allow him to stay, so he oftentimes then had to, like, if there wasn't a private family that wanted to host him overnight, he would have to drive home that night. And yeah, he was doing this 1 to 3 times a week for over a decade.
Yeah. And also doing the cooking here, the chef work here. On the UW-Madison campus. So it's amazing. Rebecca in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I tuned in a little late, and I heard some, like, really amazing stories, very personal ones about Carson Gully. And mine isn't quite that personal, but it reminded me that my father was a huge fan of Carson Gully. I grew up in rural Dane County in the 60s, born in the late 50s. And my father liked trying different recipes from the cookbook. And every year since I was a little girl, ever since I can remember, we had the Christmas salad recipe, the Christmas salad that my father made from the cookbook. It's a very long, involved dressing and overnight kind of thing. But my brother took up the mantle, and ever since I was a little girl, I've had Carson Gully Christmas salad every year that I can remember.
Oh, still make it. Oh, man. That's
lovely, Rebecca.
Rebecca, thank you so much for that story. You know, we've got a clip. This would be the perfect time to play it, I think, Tyler, of... this was Carson Gully talking with Eileen Hazard, Mrs. Hazard, on WHA radio about his recommendations and recipes for Thanksgiving and Christmas menus. And, you know, this is an old recording, so here we go. Tyler?
Celery stuffed with old Wisconsin cheese and assorted olives. Roast turkey, giblet gravy. Cornbread dressing or celery dressing. Baked ham, raisin horseradish sauce.
Just a little clip. So we got to hear his voice. And not quite as animated as maybe I would have liked it, but that was Carson Gully voice.
That's great, Larry. Thanks for playing that.
Yeah, it's and his shows were. So, and by the way, I've got to mention here that we found Jill Nadeau found a link to some of Carson's recipes. And we're putting that link up on our page, Today's Day. Go to the Larry Mueller Show and click on Today's Date, and you'll find a link to some of his recipes. And she even found his recipe for baked beans. I am so glad. Jill, thanks for that extra work there. He described, and there's a little recommendation. Jill said the reason for such long cooking is the 24 hours is that for fermentation of raw bean hulls to the stomach causes gas. Shorter cooking may tenderize the inside but leave the hull raw. But with long, slow cooking, the whole bean is thoroughly cooked, becomes butter tender, and also keeps its shape. The flavor of all ingredients is thoroughly diffused, and the whole texture is smooth.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. So if you want those recipes, go to our the Larry Mueller Show to Today's Date, and look under program notes, and we will have those there. Well, this is so much fun. And the fudge bottom pie, and you know, that fudge bottom pie went long past Carson Gully. And I think
fudge bottom pie, yeah, we still serve it on the line here in University Housing. There are several recipes of his that are still, you know, on the line in University Housing. And he's, you know, he died in 1963.
Yeah. And how did he die? I don't recall.
He had diabetes.
Diabetes. That was it. And I think his culinary accomplishment have influenced chefs, maybe even today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think certainly the culinary influence lives on among the, because he trained so many people regionally, and you know what he did. In terms of the civil rights in Madison, certainly looms large in the memory of many, and that we all owe a debt of gratitude for the way that he helped use his stature, you know, to challenge those unfair practices.
Yeah, and we've been talking about recipes. He did in 49, I think it was, 1949, published a cookbook with the Seasoning Secrets, Herbs and Spices.
Yeah, right. And then, yeah, and he kept expanding it over the course of his life. He did different editions of it. Yeah, it was popular. In fact, I bought one. I was at a garage sale here in Madison this summer, and
you found one.
Yeah.
Oh, wow! Good on you, Scott. That's great. Well, I tell you what, he and his wife were amazing people. He was certainly an amazing man, and it's I'm really so pleased that we had a chance to talk with you today about him. Scott, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a real treat. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks.
Scott Seaforth, Assistant Director of Residence Life at Academic Initiatives at UW-Madison. He wrote this article for Wisconsin Magazine of History. I think he wrote it back in 2016. It's called The Life and Times of Carson Gully. And if you want to learn a little more, I'd suggest you go online and find that article and take a look, because we didn't get through everything. But it was fun talking with him. Well, tomorrow, my goodness, it's Friday already tomorrow. And it's Garden Talk. Our guests are authors of a new book that focuses on easy-to-grow and disease-resistant varieties that will add diversity to your garden. How about that? In the meantime, I hope you stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.